Now here we go.
Most people really don't believe me. I know that. I live with that every day of my life. I've been pretty well tuned out by the media. If anything is remembered of me, I guess in the general world, what they remember is, haha, rectal probe, or he's a disturbed man, he's crazy, or something like that. But the truth is, I am not crazy. This is about emotions and feelings more powerful than human beings experience. It's about living and facing such experiences, and it is hard. It is real hard.
Bad things have happened to people from my childhood who I returned to meet again. I think I was traumatized in early childhood, and I don't think I'm real alone. I think the whole neighborhood was bruised as if an invisible fist had come.
And also, I want to go home.
I don't think that I did it. I don't know what I did exactly connected with this in terms of intelligence work.
I can't get that face out of my head.
Apparently nothing. I can't remember anything at all. Not even a snatch of anything.
Really?
You will not live if you join the CIA. But I am a very conventional person. I was not able to control what happened. As you're undoubtedly aware, there's a whole school of thought in our world that they're evil. And they wouldn't disagree with that for a minute. Dark side and evil are complicated issues. We make the dark side evil by the way we deal with it, and the grays will test you and test you and test you. The more you work with the dark side, the more successful you are, the darker they get. Until you find the only thing is surrender.
Because I cannot do a thing about this. I don't even want to look up at this.
The only thing is surrender.
Can we help you stop screaming? Can we help you stop screaming?
One of the things that you said a bit earlier was something about how the trauma was, you know, far back in his childhood. It's in the past. It's funny because I was just thinking about that idea earlier today about how the past is never past. It's always present. So I just wanted to, I wanted you to clarify that, what you said
okay.
There.
Well, the trauma, whatever the trauma was, childhood, early 20s, whatever, 1985, it is past in the immediate. The immediate experience is no longer occurring. If distance and time does absolutely nothing to change things, to heal wounds, and so on and so forth. You know, as they, you know, the old saying, time heals all wounds, maybe it doesn't. But there's a certain healing that you must allow to occur because something has occurred in the past, rather than continually dig it back up and project it in your mind's eye or write about it continually. Eventually, you have to kind of let it go. Not completely, mind you, but you develop a different relationship with it. Whereas for me, when I read some of the Whitley material, like for instance, The Rape and so on and so forth, a great piece, he seems to want to present it as if it's happening right now. It's happening right now. It's, you know, he hasn't allowed himself to develop a different relationship with it. He still has this hysterical relationship with it. I don't know if that's the best way to put it or not. So, yeah, it's like, I mean, you could say it's the past. Nothing's ever really past. It's like, well, that's kind of vague and general and not really true, I don't think. I mean, the past is the past. The present is the, you know, we're moving through time. Everything is flowing. Nothing is permanent. It's all transient. Aren't these true? The experience, whatever experience we have right now, it's like it's going to fade. Everything fades no matter how traumatic. There are Holocaust victims who get on with their lives.
So is this, are you expressing frustration with him is that he's not letting go of the past?
No, just that, well, I say no in the sense of not that he's just letting go of it, but he is insisting it's immediate, it's ongoing, the visitors are here now. I've been raped, you know. I'm not even sure if a rape victim is that inconsolable and damaged, you know, like a female, let's just say a you know, let's say we accept that Strieber is a rape victim, but let's set him as a rape victim aside and concentrate on the bulk of the rape victims out there, say, you know, usually women, but also children, but, you know, rape victims of any kind. I mean, do all rape victims write in their journals and write and write and write and write and tell stories about their rape over and over again? Develop a mythology around it?
Well, they might.
Well, yeah, they might, but I'm not aware of them. I'm aware of Whitley Strieber's because you brought it to my attention. Or Strieber's, I'm sorry. But,
And what, yeah. what's your point overall about this?
My point? Well, yeah. I'm responding to Keith's request for more detail about a comment that I made in passing.
That it's in the past.
Something I essentially believe that, you know, his trauma is in the past and there has to be some more healing than he seems to be allowing to occur or showing or demonstrating. He's using it.
That seems to be the key, that there has to be healing. So, but if there isn't healing, if healing isn't happening, then what's your take on that?
Well, my take is that it's time to realize that it's time to change a few things and relax a bit about your trauma and not pick at the wound and tell stories about it constantly and, you know,
So that's something you would want to say to Strieber himself.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, but maybe that's not the bulk of Whitley Strieber. I mean, it wasn't in an email that I sent to you recently, but I think in the second to last or the third to last chat, short little chat we did when I was at work on Google Talk there, I suggested that maybe we should leave Whitley Strieber alone. Maybe we're picking on him too much. Maybe he has a right to do everything that he's done and create everything that he's done and say everything that he's done and put forth everything that he's done, that this is how he's handling, this is how he's doing, how he's living with whatever traumas he's experienced and whatever experience he's experiencing now with all these other things that are occurring. Cause he doesn't write just about his trauma. He talks about, you know, ideas and, you know, the visit from the Keymaster, and, you know, he's on to other things at this point. So maybe he's not as focused on his past trauma, i.e. rape, as I'm presenting him to be.
Well,
let
me interject at this point, because there's two things about what you've been saying come to my mind. One is that, maybe the first one I should mention is that you're describing something or observing something and then describing it in Strieber that isn't conscious. It's not like he or anyone would be consciously keeping the trauma alive. So that's the first thing. It's an unconscious thing. So it's not enough. You can't just say to somebody else, get over it, because they think that this is how they are getting over it. And maybe it is.
Right, which was the point of my saying maybe we should just leave him alone, because maybe this is necessary.
Right. The other thing is that, and I guess this is in chapter 9, so you've just read this, is that Strieber himself says in his latest book that he has post-traumatic stress syndrome and he can't ever get over it because he never knows when it's going to happen again. He never knows. It could happen any time of the day or night, that these quote-unquote beings could just come and take him away and re-traumatize him. That's the reality, quote-unquote, that he claims to or believes that he's living in and with. So he had, I mean, whatever degree of truth there is to that, say, to me it's not really relevant, because it's sort of a chicken or egg thing. But he is, I won't say created, but he has found himself in a reality or a belief system or a situation or a predicament in which the past literally is not the past, that it's present and it can recur at any time. And that is what it is like. I mean, that's what Kalshed writes about, is that when a trauma can't be assimilated by the psyche, we end up unconsciously compelling ourselves to repeat it, to relive it, because we're seeking the resolution that we didn't get then. So, I mean, that to me is kind of, however you slice it, that's what's going on with Strieber. And the question of how real it is, in some empirical sense, we can't ever know, so it becomes irrelevant. So then the question to me, and that what does make it our business and worth looking at, is the harm that Strieber's doing to himself by this unconscious re-traumatization, but the exploitation of it by turning it into fiction, into drama, into philosophy, into, you know, soapboxing or ambassadoring for the visitors, and be the harm, the potential harm that it can have for others if he is essentially weaving a rationale for trauma. Because, of course, that's the conclusion that he comes to, is yes, he's got post-traumatic stress disorder, which he'll never get free of because it can happen at any time, the trauma. But this is a good thing, folks. This is allowing me to evolve. So you too should invite this into your lives. I mean, that's kind of, I don't know. I mean, isn't that compelling in itself, that that somebody would find themselves caught in this kind of scenario and be selling it to others, and successfully at that?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this earlier today too, about how you know, you've got the sort of the two tip classic positions on the alien question, you know, assuming that it's real. Some, you know, you have one camp that's the Space Brothers, and the other camp, they're demons, or, and Strieber seems to have taken the both position. You know, they're dastardly, and they're they'll do all these nasty things to you, but it's out of love, some kind of tough cosmic love. You know, when my inclination is not either or both, but neither.
Mm-hmm.
but it, to me, it just seems impossible to take the both position.
Impossible for you, you mean?
Yeah.
Is it not one that you would have ever, that you ever had affinity for in the past?
Yeah, it's one that I've was more open to in the past. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
You know, the, you know, I was thinking about Nietzsche's phrase, you know, what does not kill me makes me stronger. Mm-hmm. That kind of idea. But I don't think he was really, well, who knows what he was thinking, but at least I never took that to mean, you know, it's open season to just traumatize anyone around you.
I think maybe to pull out and pull back and look at it from a larger perspective, doesn't this have to do with a religious kind of interpretation of trauma, in fact, that this is Mogensen's thing, that whatever traumatizes us becomes our parent, and whatever we is too large for the psyche to assimilate becomes infinite to us, and therefore equivalent to the divine, to some religious presence. And so it seems what Strieber's doing is that he's imbuing this presence in his life with a transcendental meaning. So then, for sure, like if God stroke the universe traumatizes us, then it is helping us to evolve. That's, yeah, there's no other way to slice it. The universe stroke God doesn't get it wrong. But he's talking about actual beings that have some sort of physical reality. Not only that, they use archaic electro ejaculating probes, you know, to make him come, and he's actually got physical wounding from this rape, and so it has this awful grisly nuts and bolts reality to it, and yet somehow he has managed to imbue it with the transcendental glow of the numinous, and therefore it becomes possible for him to believe that this kind of abuse is done out of love and is furthering his own evolution.
Yeah, I mean, this gets to another point. You know, as I said before, I was raised Catholic, so I'm intimately aware with that whole experience. And when I found out that Strieber was a Catholic, I didn't really, I guess I didn't even really believe it. It just sort of seemed like, oh, maybe he was a Catholic, or he was raised Catholic, you know, I guess sort of like my position. But the more I look into the situation, his Catholicism seems absolutely central to this and to understanding anything that's going on here.
Yeah.
Just on so many different levels. The fact that he was in the school with the nuns, and whatever happened there. But also that he doesn't seem to, I mean, it boggles my mind how he could have explored so many things, Gurdjieff and, you know, crazy shit like the process, and all this other stuff, and yet he's maintained his standing in the Roman Catholic Church. And it doesn't, it doesn't appear to me anymore to be, what's the word? Like a, it appears to be very, authentic.
Well, what's that Jesuit saying? Give me a child at seven and I will give you the man, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
That's the basic, early conditioning lays down the blueprint, and everything else, I think, gets superimposed onto that. It gets worked into that original program. So this is something that Phil said. When you were reading the chapter 9 right away, you texted me that Strieber's aliens are Catholics.
Definitely.
Well, I'm kind of inclined to bring it back to the initial point about embodying the divine. I guess in the, it's the inverse of really embodying the divine. It's projecting it outward onto a physical experience. I was not sure where I'm going with this, but I touched on it with Doug, and this is in chapter 8 when he juxtaposes the rectal probe with the visitor's face, right? And that was just, I just found that so odd where he did that. You know, if there's any two things that I passed into this culture, it's the image of the rectal probe and of the visitor's face. What was I going to say? Oh, that seemed like he was actually jamming the rectal probe in the visitor's face, which would make perfect sense if he also experienced her, this great transcendental being, as this monster that raped him. Then of course he would want to, strike back at her in whatever way he could. But it may be a larger thing, which is that because he's projected, I guess you could say, his own inner divine self nature onto this phenomena, there would be a corresponding need to debase it.
Mm. Interesting.
They always go hand in hand, don't they? Like just in a relationship, if we put someone on a pedestal, we have to tear them down. If we idealize someone, we end up demonizing them.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly true.
And so with the Catholic thing, I mean, of course it's there. It's just so overt with Catholic religion that you've got this great all-powerful God, and then you have to conjure his shadow and the satanic presence, but at the same time, God himself is the one who sends sinners to hell for all eternity to be tortured by Satan. So you could say God is even worse than Satan, really. Satan's just working for God. That's just really clear, obvious logic, if you just apply logic to it, which of course Catholics don't. But then that the demonic angel thing is what Strieber is actually presenting with pain, that the visitors are demonic angels who will torture us in order to liberate us from our sin. Crack the ego. And from my little limited experience, my larger experience in general, but also my limited experience with David Shahn and what I've seen of him and how he approaches enlightenment or getting free of the ego, that's absolutely the last way to approach it. You don't torture someone out of their conditioning. That's just reconditioning.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, thinking, going back to my own Catholic experience, I mean, you're sitting there in a church, you know, on your knees, and there's a massive crucifix on the wall. This guy is just wearing, you know, a loincloth, and he's nailed to the cross, and that is the central focus. It's the biggest thing. It's right in the middle, and you stare at it every day, you know, 5 days a week before school, and it's just burned into your brain. And you know, and this is this is God.
This is God, and he's being punished for your sins.
Right.
Which is what happened to Strieber, that this man is being punished for your sins.
Yeah. So, wait, it's his son, isn't it? Or no?
It was just this guy, but then when he, and it was a vision, and the visitor was telling him it's not real, which is somehow supposed to make it better, but I think you could say that might even potentially make it worse, because he's seeing it, it's as real as to him, and then the voice is telling him not to even believe what he's seeing, so that's sort of creating a schism in his psyche. But anyway, he then wakes up in his house, and he hears his son screaming, and then he's told that his son's being punished for his transgressions, as in for Whitley's transgressions.
Yeah, I read that. I read that as, well, particularly the voice telling him it's not real. I read that as being kind of his higher self telling him this is not real. Although that there could be any number of ways to read that.
I would have thought it's kind of a dissociative mechanism. Isn't it spelled out, really, if you're in
like a crazy making?
It is crazy. It seems to me that it would be crazy making, because I don't know. He, you know, his experience was that it was so real that he would have done anything to be in that man's place and be receiving the beating in his place. So,
yeah, that, I mean, regardless, that is straight out of Catholicism.
It's also a sadomasochistic kind of scenario.
Like you said, it's straight out of Catholicism.
But, you know, I mean, plenty of Catholics have turned their back. I mean, Joyce, James Joyce, and any number of writers, you know, sort of seen through all that fucking shit and come through the other side. Just makes me wonder, you know, why he has never done that. Anyway.
Well, I mean, the obvious answer is that he was severely traumatized, perhaps even as part of his conditioning, but certainly in those formative years while he was being conditioned to be Catholic. Part of it included dissociating and having visions of demons and angels, as he said, when he was in the box. That was what he described it as. He saw demons and then he saw angels. And then somehow that, like his trauma or his distress, I think, as he describes it, again, we're not really talking about necessarily a real person, but the narrative, the protagonist of these narratives is somebody whose distress is so great that they have to summon divine intervention, and it has to intervene. It has to have a physical impact on his world. It has to become a physical presence, because that's what divine intervention is, right? It's this God entering into this world. to change reality. And so Strieber's narrative is that, is of a boy that's in such great distress that he calls to and is answered by these beings from another realm that physically intervenes. So of course that's an angelic rescue, that's divine fiat. So that would reinforce all of his Catholic program, might make it totally totally hardwired into his psyche, so that he would have a scientific basis for it in the end, as in a rational, materialistic basis, that the angels, this higher civilization, as he calls it, that feeds off this one.
Yeah, I guess it is. It's the same as praying for the intercession of the saints. Very Catholic idea.
Mm-hmm. So I think we are talking about something here that's been going on from the beginning of beginning of civilization, at least. Like, as soon as humans started becoming self-conscious, and this relates to the Julian Jaynes material, which is the bicameral mind, and how the beginnings of self-consciousness related to having an experience of the gods speaking to us, because prior to this, like primitive man experienced the gods as the gods' intervention was internal. So, this is what he describes in bicameral mind is that in the Iliad, the gods are described as impulses. So whenever one of the characters, I think it's the Iliad, yeah it is, whenever one of the characters has to act and or experience some profound emotion that leads to action, the gods are introduced as characters.
Mm-hmm.
So what he posits is that like early man didn't have an ego self, didn't have a sense of himself as an individual, wasn't conscious of himself existing as an individual. So when he had to make a decision, so it was as if something possessed him and moved through him, and that gradually developed to the point where the early man would experience it as the voice of God telling him or her what to do. And so then temples would be built, and you would go to temples, and that was the place where you would listen and hear the voice of God. But essentially it was this part of the psyche that was moving through the individual. But the more and more the ego or the self-conscious self came into being, the more it was possible and even necessary to experience that inner impulse of the divine, if you will, as something outside of the individual. And now we're at a stage, of course, where we're totally sealed in this self-conscious ego self, and so we can't even hear the voice of the gods at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so then for the divine to affect us, it has to be given some sort of reality that the ego, materialist ego mind, can recognize. It's saying. But that's not it. I mean, it isn't it. When that happens, it's... I don't know what's going on. I mean, this is big picture questions. Like, my feeling is there are beings that Strieber's interacting with and fucking with them, and not just human ones, and that they're playing on this need, this disconnect in us, and this need to have contact and interact with the divine and be guided by it and handled by it, they're playing on that and exploiting that and actually using the energy of our belief and of our awareness, our reverence for that part of ourselves that we've lost contact with, to become like gods, like godlike forces in our lives.
Yeah, that's, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I think when we first started, or, you know, at least maybe let's say a month ago, I was really leaning towards total human, you know, no outside forces involved, just purely human phenomenon. But, yeah, it's just been, I've been coming back to the idea that I think there are non-human agencies involved that are basically not to be trusted. You know, the trickster element.
Yeah, well, it certainly is very difficult to separate the strands, if not impossible, I would say.
But it you know, for me, I just whether or not that's whether or not there's a trickster element there, I mean, we shouldn't be paying any fucking attention to what it has to say. That's my opinion.
Well, isn't that what we're doing here today, though? Paying attention?
Well, not, I mean...
Well,
I guess what I'm saying is we shouldn't be taking it at face value and saying, "Oh, look, I've made contact with divine entities or messengers of the divine." I mean, that's just
no, absolutely
fucking dangerous.
Yeah, my sense is that. And this is somewhat based on observing Strieber, sifting through his narratives, but that I'm not sure how to phrase this, that, well, let's say because the divine, by definition, is the core reality, you know, that it's the gold in the dirt. It's what has true value. Doesn't matter what we call it, but it's like the quick of authentic experience. By definition, it's the deepest part of ourselves. Like we have to go all the way to our very center, to our very core, to tap that divine essence. And so, if we start finding clues of it and following hints of it and leads and tips and getting payoffs outside of ourselves, we're going to get pulled more and more out of our center.
Yeah.
That as long as, I mean, the degree to which we're experiencing outside of ourselves is the degree to which we're actually getting further and further from it, I think.
Yeah.
I agree.
But that's not what people want to hear. Like, I mean, how many millions of people are waiting for the second coming? And how many millions more are waiting for the mothership? And how many millions more are waiting for Muhammad? And how many are waiting for the Jewish Messiah? Maitreya, that guy, the Buddhist? I mean, my God, we're in the minority here.
Well, that's what's, I think, so frustrating to me about all this, is that I think it's just becoming clearer and clearer to me that this is the beginnings of a new religion, but it's no fucking different. It's got all of the same elements.
Right.
It's got its apocalypse. It's got its fucking guilt and just everything. Everything, it's like a overlay, but it's just a polished turd for the 21st century.
Well, it has one difference, maybe, and that's, as the song goes, it's scientific.
Yeah, and it's even more literal. As if that was even possible, but.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's been the case ever since they've, you know, at least since the 40s. I've seen old documentary footage of people who look very much like long-haired hippies out in a rock in the desert waiting for UFOs in the 50s. Waiting for the Space Brothers because of all the Venusian experiences people were having, and you know, a lot of sex on flying saucers back then. You know, so blonde-haired, blue-eyed Venusian woman would take you into her ship, and you know, a sort of an Aryan sort of race of super beings who were here to usher us into the golden age. I mean, it's been part and parcel of it. And Carl Jung, I mean, he was, you know, flying saucers, a modern myth of things seen in the sky, the saucer shape and wholeness and the self. And of course, that's all tied up with archetypal / divine experiences. And, you know, if you get deep into it enough and take it literally enough, of course, it could develop into something very much like a religion, if not a, you know, very fully formed, well-functioning one, but one nonetheless, one way or the other, cults, which are just religions, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Did it seem like that was happening, though, like in the last few decades, or did it seem like that was sort of a fad that had kind of fizzled out?
Well, I think that's just a persistent aspect of the UFO phenomenon among what you might call believers. It's persistent, and yet, to me, it strangely enough has never quite seemed to gel, you know? I know Whitley Strieber supposedly has some number of followers and so forth, but really how many, you know? And is it not waning? Hasn't it reached its epitome? I don't think it's going to burst forth into the larger society any more than it has already. And same goes for any other UFO-based religion. I really don't see a lot of that in the small sense. Maybe in a larger sense as part of the general worldview of people, but, you know, a specific religion with a specific mythology, I guess one that is good enough has not really come along to really capture enough people. So, but yeah, it's there. You know, the whole scientism that you brought up, science as a religion, of course, the UFOs, the Space Brothers or whatever, are for some people, gods of science, but for many scientists, absolute hogwash. So what are we talking about? The science as scientists practice it? Or people who make a religion of science and read things like the Tao of physics and think that they understand physics now because, you know, they see some connection with Taoism and dancing Wu Li masters and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I don't know exactly where it's headed, but yeah, it's something I see, but it's not something that I've perceived for myself. It's just pretty self-evident, isn't it?
Well, I think at the moment it's more in the nature of a meme, and I guess if we go back to Christianity, I mean that would have seemed like a wacky cult for the first couple of hundred years, wouldn't it?
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, but the meme was growing, and then it took the Roman Empire to actually adapt the meme and say, okay, this is the one we're going to back now, because this is going to support our system, that this is going to help further our empire and prop it up. So I think that that's what's going on. I think that the UFO is a meme, and that there's all these different cults sort of coming up, and Strieber's being one, and Stephen Greer being another, and so on and so forth, centering around the idea of the UFO and the alien stroke visitor stroke extraterrestrial, and that the powers that be, the empire that never ended, is just keeping an eye on seeing which horse to back, or maybe use all of them. I mean, maybe it's not necessary to actually unify them all into one great religion. Maybe that'll happen over time, but I think the main thing that is happening is that more and more people just have this, they've been indoctrinated is a loaded term, but they've
conditioned,
adopted these ideas. Like if you ask people if they believe in extraterrestrials, most people say, I've had this conversation with a guy in the grocery store the other day, they'll all say the same thing. They'll say, well, the universe is so big that there must be life out there. It's like they've been programmed with this. I mean, okay, it's probably true, but still, it's remarkable how that idea has just taken hold in people's psyche, and that's kind of how they now perceive the question. Or even if you ask about UFOs, they might say that, in fact, rather than, taking it as a UFO, well, that's unidentified, so you could be talking about any number of things. They'll immediately jump to, oh, the universe is so large that there must be life out there, so yeah, I believe in UFOs. That's not logical thinking. See, that's conditioned thinking.
Yeah, I mean, you'll still see the media or, you know, the news or something run like a dismissive piece on, you know, how wacky it is to believe in UFOs or aliens or whatever. But, I mean, if you just look at the number of films, forget about the television shows and the books that have been written, but just films alone that have dealt with alien invasions and in the last just two decades, I mean, I think if you were to add them all up, it would just be fucking blow your mind. So, yeah, I think the vast majority of people, at least in this country, I don't know about the rest of the planet, but it's not really, some things happened, you know, where the tables have turned. It's no longer, the predominant view is no longer that this is something to ridicule, or maybe it is. Maybe people still ridicule it, but I think, again, the vast majority of people accept the basic idea that, maybe they're not here right now, but I mean, when you add up all of the different elements, the Space Brother idea, the alien invasion idea, the ancient astronaut idea, the whole genetic manipulation concept.
Mm-hmm.
You just...
And it's based on so little, really. I mean, you could say there's a huge amount of smoke, but there's almost no visible fire. So, I mean, yeah, there's been sightings throughout history. Yeah, people are having these very consistent experiences of beings coming into their room. And people have implants inserted into their bodies and so on and so forth. Yeah, there are men in black. But in terms of the actual picture that's being created and accepted, there's almost no evidence, no real evidence for an extraterrestrial presence, I would say. That's my sense.
And, you know, add into the mix all the channeled material where you're supposedly communicating with... you know, for example, the Council of Nine with Puharich. This is a really, in my mind, a really fucking dangerous idea. You've got individuals who are claiming to be in contact with the ancient gods of Egypt. I mean, once an idea like that is able to take off and people are willing to accept, okay, this group of people is in contact with our creator gods.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm very puzzled.
We're in fucking trouble, man.
I'm not going to disagree with that, but at the same time, like, I'm kind of with Phil on this, and that I don't believe that people really believe this. That's what I find it. I think it's maybe that's hard, or that's one of the reasons why people who maybe should be taking this seriously aren't. Because there's just something about it that just seems so off. Like, it's like make believe. Even though we know it's not, like, the consequences are real, you know, people are acting on these beliefs, and are even physical implants and stuff, so the military clearly does seem to be involved, black helicopters, all the rest of it. It definitely overlaps with nuts and bolts reality and stuff that can affect us directly, you know, on a personal level, and yet it feels like, no, this is all just some big fantasy out there.
I would argue that it doesn't really matter whether people believe it or not. Whether they really believe it or not.
Whether they really believe it, yeah. As long as they believe it.
Yeah, and as long as they're making decisions or acting as if they believe, what the fuck is the difference?
Mm-hmm.
On a practical level. I mean, if they don't really believe, then it's even more frightening.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know what that buys you to parse that out like that. I mean, unless you think that maybe there's, you know, more of an opportunity to address it.
Well, I mean, my question is always, like, what's in it for me? What's in it for others? Like, is there anything to be gained by passing it out? Is there anything to be gained by exploring and identifying these all the different layers of deception and delusion? I think there is, to some extent, at an individual level, and that can be part and parcel of looking at the collective delusion. But I'm always unsure, you know, where at what point it becomes self-defeating. to do this, because if one is focusing on the error and the deception and the delusion and the fantasy, even if it is specifically in order to get rid of it, you're still putting your attention on those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's kind of the flip side of the addiction, like a dry drunk. Maybe we're becoming dry, you know, euphoholics. Like, Phil, you say you left this alone, and you know, maybe that's part of the tension that you're feeling, is that you've got pulled back into this, and fuck, you know, you don't want to drink anymore. You don't want to be around this stuff.
I think Phil nodded off.
Yeah. Just following along.
Well, you know, I think we can all agree the UFO by nature is an obsessive. It engenders obsession, right?
It can.
Like sex, like drugs, like religion.
Mm-hmm. It touches on something.
Again,
if Jung is to be accepted to any degree, then of course it touches on archetypal psyche, what have you. Mm-hmm. So of course anything that does that is going to have a power and a meaning and a significance, and whether you want it to or not, you know.
Thinking about Jeffrey again in Blue Velvet, this thing of being drawn into a mystery. Once you glimpse that there's something there that's hidden, that's never been seen, it's almost impossible to resist the desire to look closer and find out what's there. But then, once you find out what is there and that you really don't want to see it, it's too late. You're already trapped in the closet.
Yeah. It's a good metaphor.
Blue Velvet's got that science fiction feel. I always noticed that when I first saw it. It was like, is this a science fiction movie or what? Because everything's a bit off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the people don't act quite like people. So I would say, like, for me, maybe all present company, I don't know, included, the sort of compulsion to look into this is part of a larger compulsion, which is to get to that splinter in the brain that's just constantly nagging and saying something's not right. So then if you get into the UFO narrative, you start to believe that some people are aliens and that the government's tapping your phones and all this glamorous kind of quasi-information that you can gather, and then you can imbue your life with meaning that accounts for that feeling that something's not right. Of course something's not right, because the hybrids are messaging me on my cell phone, you know? I'm in trouble.
You know, this is something I was speaking to my wife earlier today about how, like, conspiracy theories, and she was at some teacher training thing, and I guess a bunch of the teachers started talking about 9/11 and how it was a government cover-up and so forth, and they were just speaking freely, and she was just kind of shocked that so many people were coming forward and expressing these opinions. Something has happened.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a sort of a sea change or a shift where people are, where a lot of this stuff has gone mainstream, and people are willing to entertain certain ideas that that they just weren't capable or willing to enter into, let's say, 10 or 15 years ago. That's my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I see it with the kids too, with the middle school students that I teach. They're way more open to a lot of sort of quote unquote crazy ideas. Now, you could say that this is a good thing, that people are opening their minds, they're considering a wider spectrum of possibilities. But I think there's a dark side to it too. Because it means that people have the potential to accept ideas that don't really make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the conclusions that you'll hear from people don't make sense. But there's a fundamental truth behind it, which is that something's not right. I think that's real.
And for me, I don't know how much distance I can get from all that, but I've found that I need a little bit of breathing space between
conspiracy theories.
A pile of conspiracy theories and beliefs that I harbor myself and everything. I need a little space. Everybody needs a little space between those things. And a lot of this, which I think is one of the factors leading up to the situation we started out discussing, which is, at least for me anyways, not maintaining enough breathing space in between myself and the material.
Right.
Because, you know, again, I focus in on a thing, you know, and react to it as if it's there with me.
Right.
As if there's another person in the room and I'm having a discussion, possibly an argument. It's hot and it's sweaty and, you know, there's, you know, bright lights and stuff's happening and I have to react, kind of thing, you know. Breathe, I got to remember. And everyone else too.
Well, imagine if Whitley was your uncle and he was like living with you for 6 months and you had to hear him talk all day long. But well, he wasn't Whitley because he hadn't any bestsellers, so no one actually believed him, so he really just needed you to believe him.
Yeah. Well, I have an Uncle Gary who runs the pool hall down the street, and he has a lot of UFO theories and conspiracy ideas and so on and so forth. I don't have to deal with him every day, but yeah, I have uncles enough like that. But yeah, not sure how I'd react. As long as possible, I'd try to like take in the information and engage him over it. But depending on his style of engagement, it would lead to conflict or not lead to conflict. If he could calm down and actually discuss things with me and allow me to ask questions and not jump on me every time that I suggest anything that contradicts what he's putting forth or how he's putting it forth, especially how he's putting it forth, is I think even more important to Uncle Whitley. Then, you know, that's going to cause more and more violent reaction from me. If I can't, it's like, okay, I'm here too. This is me. This is, maybe I'm limited. Maybe I'm stupid. Maybe I'm slow. Maybe I don't fucking understand. I'm going to ask these fucking questions, you know? And if, you know, if I can't, and if I get no respect for that, and there's just constant backlash because of it, might as well kill the guy. Or throw him out of the house, really, is what I'd do. I would kill him. But yeah, it could get violent.
Well, I was using it as a kind of counterpoint, but also in a sense to suggest that maybe that's what it is like for you, if you're on the autistic spectrum, that you find yourself kind of unconsciously or unwittingly, or without wanting to, tuning in to another person. Like if you're reading all this material about Whitley, part of you may actually be tuning into him and connecting to him at some non-physical level. I don't think that there's anything far-fetched about that based on my experience, and I suspect that you probably don't find that too far-fetched either.
Nope.
And if that is happening, then you might actually really be feeling psychically crowded, like it's hard for you to separate yourself from him.
Crowded's a good word for it, yeah.
That's what's going on with me. And add to that the fact that you're not, like, all that I've found out about Willie that I'm putting out there is the result of spending 20 years reading him, and that began with this enormous affection and admiration for him. It's only in the last few years that it's gradually condensing into this powerful feeling of disturbance and distaste and concern and all the rest of it. So, but you're getting the condensed version, you're getting the syrup that's come from boiling down all this sugar, and it could be a lethal dose of Whitley in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's a good way to put it, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I should say, hopefully homeopathic, not lethal, but the poison that is the cure.
Well, it has caused me to, in some areas, to reconsider other things about myself, as everything really does, you know. Like, for instance, my response to the rape article last night, and then your response/responses to my response. And then I started writing another response to your response to the response to the response. And I typed until about 2 a.m. And then I realized, wait a minute, this is pointless. There's just going to be another response to my response to the response to the response to the response. And do I really believe any of this? It's like I can react off of things and say stuff that I completely don't believe or agree with just in reaction to something that's, again, that crowding effect and the, you know, sweaty, reactive, sort of hothead sort of response in some respect. And then just ultimately, I just kind of reread it all and I thought, okay, I'll think about that. And then I deleted it all. And I decided to just allow these impulses in me to respond to your response to my response to your response, to let them course through me. And what can I learn from that? What is it? Did he trigger something in me? Was I challenged in some way? Now am I doubting myself? Is this a valid doubt or an invalid doubt? What's the nature of this? Are we having a conflict? Is there a problem here? Or is he pointing out, all that stuff back and forth? It's like, well, I got more out of that than I would have sending a response. There's really no need to do that. And then I read your autoculture post and I thought, well, fuck, man, that's not too far away from what I'm not. Fuck it. I'm not bad. I'm not fucking stupid. I'm not slow, you know? Jesus Christ, you know? And to go back to one of the early points that I made about the, you know, that whole, and this is my personal way of framing a thing for myself. I'm not going to write anything and put it out in the world to say this. I'm saying it to my two internet buddies here. The undifferentiated wholeness to differentiated wholeness, and the various periods of bonding and togetherness that we feel, and wholeness that we feel, then we start to see areas in which we're different, and then that breaks apart and ends, and then we flow into another period of wholeness, and then we learn things of what we are like, and then we start to see ways that we're not like it, and that we break apart, and as we go through that process, we differentiate, and we become more and more conscious, and hopefully more aware and more deeper, more complex, more interesting individuals, hopefully. And people who are friends and then find an area where they completely conflict or conflict in a certain sense, to me, it's a sign of lack of awareness and a certain weakness if you take that too literally and react and say, okay, we're no longer friends because we just differ and it's totally different. There's conflict. I can't stand any conflict. You get over there and I'm going to go over here and let's never talk again kind of thing. Instead of sitting and think, okay, well, what? Why do I feel that way? Let me examine that. Maybe that's an area where I've become attached to something that's no longer working for me, and I'm defending that. You know, the whole crucial fictions issue. You know, And then you examine your crucial fiction. Why is it crucial? Do you going to change it? Are we going to be able to let go of all of our fictions? I don't think so. Maybe fictions are crucial, and we can't, as Whitney can't possibly. Maybe he can never get out of his personal mythos that he's built up around whatever happened, whatever he has experienced. We can't really get out of those fictions completely. Maybe there's an enlightenment, a stage of enlightenment where we're beyond all the fictions. And I understand ego is a fiction. And when you recognize it as a fiction, blah, 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 all that stuff, and then possibly leads to an enlightenment. But short of enlightenment, we're probably never going to get out of those fictions. Now, I mean, what's more boring than as Hollywood does, makes the same fucking movie every goddamn year over and over again. That's what we do. Our brains are, we're Hollywood, you know, we're fucking Hollywood, and our crucial fiction, you know, these fictions that we build up, it's like, they're so repetitive. And it's like, well, how about something a little more interesting and something more real, more meaningful on a personal basis? You know, as you mature, your film should be less repetitive and shallow, and they should become deeper and they should become more interesting, just as you should and your fictions, your own crucial fiction should. So there's that process, and all of that is involved, I believe, in something just as simple as me reading the Whitley piece last night and going off on that, and then you responding to back and forth, and you know, me laying there and typing and then stopping. And it's an opportunity. It's a fucking opportunity to grow, develop, possibly realize a few things about myself. You start off feeling bad. It feels really bad. But then after that, I started feeling even better than I did before. And it was a positive experience. So it's like, God damn it, Jason, I'm going to type till 2 fucking in the morning. It's like, wait a minute. And then delete, think. Okay, relax, go to bed, sleep, wake up. Here we are, talking again. No harm, no foul. You know what I mean? And that process goes on. And to be conscious of that, that's kind of part of the nature of the process. Me being maybe not the smartest guy, not the sharpest guy, not the most aware guy, not the most intuitive guy, not the most anything guy. Maybe there's a lot more that could be said around that, but that's my personal level of understanding. And that's where I operate from, or at least I try to operate from. When I remember, that's where I operate from. Generally, when I'm thrown into that defensive sort of posture, then I stop for a second and I think, wait a minute, I'm in that defensive posture. Let's go back to that more aware state and try to get something out of this. More than just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. There's no fucking end to that.
It's not a sex story. There has forever been the notion that something higher than men had to be fed on human souls.
Curiosity knows no bounds. I'd like to sleep with the whole town.
It takes the fire of great agony to burn away these confused notions. That is the reason for the suffering associated with sacrifice. The greatest sacrifice produces the greatest learning. The most blessed are those who suffer the most. It's not a sex story at all. It's a story about the dangerous sacred. It's not a sex story.
The creature's out to prowl around.
For reasons that will become clear, I was earmarked for special suffering.
As my understanding has increased, I have come to love my tormentors and share with them their own solemnity.
Out of their dreams and into his.
To wreak mayhem in the world is not the responsibility of demons, but of angels.
To solid ground, out of their dreams and into his.
The greater our learning, the happier the angels.
Endless hunger, endless God.
Pain breaks down the barriers of ego, of personality, of false self.
Without smile.
Witness the book of Job,
endless hunger,
which in the secret text Janet uses is called the Book of Man.
She will rock you like a child.
Earmarked for special suffering.
She will rock you like a child.
Earmarked for special
she
suffering.
She will rock you.
As my understanding has increased, I have come to love my tormentors and share with them their own sorrows.